I've been asked to address three questions this afternoon. When does marriage begin? When does marriage end? And under what circumstances may someone formerly married remarry? So let's just begin with the first one. When does a marriage begin? There are probably three most common answers to that question are as follows. God considers a man and woman married when they are legally married. That is, when the law recognizes it. A man and woman are considered married when they have completed some kind of formal wedding ceremony involving covenantal vows. And thirdly, God considers a man and woman to be married at the moment they engage in sexual intercourse. I find that there is some truth in some of these, but all truth is found in none of them. Let's examine them and see what we find. Number one, marriage begins when a couple is legally married. The rationale for this is Romans chapter 13, verses 1 and 2, where Paul tells us that we are to be subject to the governing authorities, that there's no authority except from God. The authorities that exist are appointed by God, and if we resist that authority, we resist the ordinance of God. So since the government has chosen to regulate marriage, we are responsible for honoring that, and the government dictates to us when a marriage begins. Well, we are certainly supposed to submit ourselves to the governing authorities insofar as they are in harmony with the laws of God. Acts chapter 5, verse 29, Peter said we ought to obey God rather than men. And this is where we kind of run into a hitch. There are multiple problems giving the government this power to tell us when a marriage begins. Number one, marriage existed long before there was any civil government to regulate it and license it. So we can't rely on the government just from that standpoint, but more to the point, in our own time. There are countries, even today, that do not recognize, the government does not recognize marriage or give any legal requirements for it. So if you live in a country whose government doesn't even recognize marriage and gives no requirements or any requirements for it, how do you get married if you depend on the government? Thirdly, some governments have, and still do, create unbiblical requirements for a marriage to be recognized. It is true even today that there are places you can go where in order to be married, your wedding must take place in a Catholic church, it must be in accordance with Catholic teachings, and it must be overseen by a Catholic priest. This was certainly true in the 1260 years, the time, times, and half a time, and it remains true today. How was a Christian supposed to get married when he knew that the Roman Catholic teachings concerning marriage were unbiblical? Clearly, it was not dependent upon what the government said. There had to be and continues to have to be a way for Christians to be married when the government is not putting biblical parameters on it. And fourthly, if the government is who tells us when a marriage begins, what do you do when your government says that two people can get married who are of the same gender? Clearly, that doesn't work. So insofar as man's laws agree with God's laws, we certainly will follow them. But God has never given the government power to tell us when a marriage begins, not in the strictest sense. Viewpoint number two said that marriage begins when a couple has completed a ceremony involving some kind of vow. I'm smiling because sometimes it's amazing how far we will go if we really want to prove something. We decide what we believe is true, and then we try to come up with arguments to prove it. It is believed by some that in Genesis chapter 2, verse 22, when God brought Eve to Adam, that God was actually initiating a ceremony. And that this is why, when a father brings his bride down to the groom, he's doing that because that's what God did with Eve. He was the great father. He brought Eve and presented her to Adam. Furthermore, Jesus performed his first miracle, and where did he perform it? At a wedding. So God's telling us that a wedding ceremony is something that he wants. That's kind of how the argument goes. Well, Genesis 2:22 says nothing about what God did being a ceremony. God had made Eve. Eve needed to meet Adam. Adam needed to meet Eve. So, of course, God brought her to him. But there's nothing in there to suggest that it was a ceremony. And this supposed connection between what God did with Eve and what we do when we have a marriage ceremony is completely erroneous, and any research into that will reveal that. This is rooted in the traditions of man. It's not rooted in anything that God did at Eden. Furthermore, just because Jesus attended a wedding does not tell us that he requires it. What Jesus countenanced, he did not necessarily require. If we take that position, we're going to find we need to do a whole lot of things. So that argument doesn't really hold up. Some have argued that marriage begins with the sexual union. That, in fact, sexual intercourse constitutes marriage. And I have known at least one, I'm sure there have been many more, in the church who believed this. It's rooted in Genesis 2:24. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. One flesh is speaking to the sexual union, so the argument goes. Man puts the final seal on marriage when he engages in that relationship. He and his wife, he and his sort of wife, consummate the marriage. And how many of us in this room have used that term? Consummate the marriage. To finalize the marriage. It's not a biblical idea. Genesis 2:24 says, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. They shall be joined in marriage, and the two who are joined in marriage shall become one flesh. The union in marriage is entirely separate from the physical union of the sexual act. That has to be true. If it's not, there's no such thing as premarital sex, which the Bible clearly says there is. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 2 says one of the reasons we get married is so that we won't engage in sexual immorality. But if sexual union creates marriage, there's no such thing as premarital sex. If the sexual union creates marriage, anyone who is sexually promiscuous is either a polygamist, a prostitute, I'm sorry, I hope I'm not being too crass here, but could be married to thousands of people. Or I take the position that it started the marriage and then the next night or two nights later, then that marriage gets broken and a new marriage gets started. So you've got people who've been married thousands of times or are married to thousands of people if we take that position. And finally, and most compellingly, I think, is what Jesus said in John 4:18. What did he say to the Samaritan woman? He says, go bring your husband. She says, I have no husband. He says, in that you have spoken truly, because you have had five husbands, and the one you have now, what? This woman had been married five times before, but now she's shacking up with someone. The clear implication is they're sharing a bed. And what does Jesus say? He's not your husband. Becoming one flesh, engaging in the sexual union is something that comes upon marriage, but it does not produce the marriage. So if marriage is not produced, it does not begin just because the government says it begins at thus and so. If marriage doesn't begin just because or by a ceremony, and if marriage doesn't begin as a result of the sexual act, then when does marriage begin according to the Bible? Malachi chapter 2 verse 14, God said to the Jewish husbands, he spoke of their wives in this way. She is the wife of your youth. She is your companion and your wife by covenant. There is what makes a man and a woman husband and wife, a covenant. A covenant is a compact. It is an agreement between two parties in this case based on promises that each has made to the other. The promise that I am your husband, I take you as my wife, and conversely, I am your wife, I take you as my husband. But God prescribes no particular procedure by which this is to be accomplished. It certainly requires communication of some kind, either verbal, written, even signing. But it does need to be a promise, needs to be communicated in good faith that I am taking you as my spouse and vice versa. And since the laws of our country, at least for now, do honor heterosexual marriage in a biblical way, we do need to work in harmony with the laws of the land. We have no grounds that I can see at this point to run counter to them. So since the laws of the land do recognize heterosexual marriage and we're to obey the laws of the land insofar as they agree with the laws of God, if you're living in the state of Missouri, yes, you need to go get a license and then enter into that covenant in good faith. Does there have to be a ceremony? I believe in Missouri, if I understand the laws correctly, I've not researched this as far as I should. I've never needed to up to this point, but there does need to be an officiant if you're going to have any kind of ceremony. So that officiant's got to meet certain requirements. So of course, you need to be in harmony with those. But that can be a justice of the peace, as you know. But the Bible doesn't prescribe any kind of ceremony. Abraham sent his servant all the way up to Haran. His servant comes back with Rebekah. Everybody knew why the servant had left. Everybody knew that if the servant came back, he was bringing with him Isaac's wife. He paid Rebekah's family a dowry before he left. He shows up with Rebekah, and what does the scripture say? Genesis 24:67, Isaac brought Rebekah into his mother's tent. He took Rebekah, and she became his wife. Now, might there have been more to the story? Yes. But might there not have been more to the story? Yes, we don't know. I have been told that it was true, at least in years past, among some in the among the Native Americans, that it was understood you became married once you'd built a teepee together. God does not prescribe the way in which the covenant is made, but he is clear there needs to be a covenant. I was astonished to learn, while having to research this question a number of years ago in Colorado, that if you want to be married in Colorado, all the law says is you have to share your possessions and you have to tell people you're married. That's marriage in Colorado. So easy laws to fulfill, but that doesn't determine it. But certainly if there's a covenant made between two people and they follow the, meet those requirements, they certainly would be married. Your wife and husband by covenant, promise, made in good faith. When does a marriage end? Romans chapter 7 tells us that a marriage ends when one of the spouses dies. Romans 7 beginning in verse 2. For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then if, while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. It's all very straightforward, but if I'm married and my spouse dies, the Bible says I am free to remarry. However, if I am a Christian, Paul says I am free to remarry whomever I wish except what? 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39, only in the Lord. I am expected, if I am a Christian, to marry a Christian. Are there any other circumstances under which a marriage can end and a previously married person can remarry? Yes. And we'll spend the rest of our time at answering that. There are 8 pertinent passages in the New Testament concerning marriage, divorce, and remarriage. I don't think it's necessary for us to look at all 8 of those. I've chosen 2, and I think they give us what we need. I'm going to begin in Matthew chapter 19, if you'd like to join me there. Matthew chapter 19. We'll begin in verse 3. Matthew 19, beginning in verse 3. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him, and saying to him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?" He answered and said to them, "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate." They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" He said to them, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery." Verse 3, the Pharisees posed the question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? Why were they asking that question? Well, yeah, clearly somebody was wanting to get a divorce. This was a long-standing question between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees adopted the teachings of Hillel, a well-known rabbi in the intertestamental period. The Sadducees followed a man named Shammai. And these two men took very different positions on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Hillel, the starter, if you will, of the Pharisees, said that a man could divorce his wife even for spoiling his food. Shammai, who brought about the Sadducees, or at least whose teachings on this subject the Sadducees followed, interestingly took a far more conservative position. He said that she had to be guilty of adultery. Well, you say, well, how can you have a disagreement on that scale? Well, it all came down to Deuteronomy 24:1, where Moses said a man could divorce his wife if he found, quote, some uncleanness in her. And the question was, what constitutes uncleanness? Shammai and the Sadducees said that's only adultery. Hillel and the Pharisees said could be almost anything. So they bring this question to Jesus. Now, Jesus had already taught on this subject. All the way back in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, he had already taught the same thing. Whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. Maybe they'd heard that, maybe they hadn't, but here they present the question to him. What was Jesus' answer? What was his answer? Well, he goes all the way back to the beginning. He says, don't you remember all the way back in Genesis, God made one man, one woman, brought them together in marriage. And in verse 6, Jesus says, so then, here's my first answer to your question. So then, they are no longer two, but one flesh. Who made them one flesh? God. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man what? So this is the baseline answer. Now there's not all to the answer, it's not all the answer, but this is the beginning. And this is the answer that Paul's going to return to. This is the answer that keeps getting reiterated in the New Testament on this subject. When the question is first posited, is it okay to divorce for just any reason? Jesus' initial answer is, God brought the marriage together and what? Don't break it. Don't break it. God brought the marriage together. Don't break it. That's the answer. And the only reason Jesus goes any further is because they prompt him. What does the Bible say that how does God feel about divorce? He hates it. Malachi chapter 2. God hates divorce. Paul is going to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 verse 11, a woman is not to divorce her husband. A husband is not to divorce his wife. This is God's baseline teaching. So they respond to this, verse 7, well, if you're saying that, because they heard him loud and clear, why did Moses give a certificate of divorce and say we could put her away? Which is an understandable question. You're saying that divorce is not supposed to happen, but Moses said it could happen. Why are you saying what you are? Well, Jesus says in verse 8, yes, Moses permitted it. You know, they said Moses commanded it. Jesus says Moses permitted it. Words mean things. Moses permitted it, but he permitted it. In other words, God permitted it through Moses for only one reason. And what was that reason in verse 8? Because of what? The hardness of your hearts. Hardness indicates an unwillingness to yield, an unwillingness to submit. Moses permitted this because you would not submit to God's laws. The Jews came out of Egypt with very low moral standards. And God in his wisdom saw that a national metamorphosis in beliefs and behavior was not going to happen overnight. God in his wisdom saw that at least for now there were bigger fish to fry. So God said, I will permit the divorce for now under the circumstances he gave. But Jesus again says in verse 8, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, what? It was not so. First of all, if you ever look at the law on this question, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, the law that was received at Mount Sinai, never mentions divorce. Divorce is never mentioned as an option until 40 years later when the law is being given again, and they've had 40 years to live under the law, and apparently they weren't doing a very good job on a number of points, this one included, and so Moses, God inspires him, of course, Moses says, all right, you can divorce. Your hardness of heart had revealed itself and God made an allowance. But Jesus takes it all the way back to the beginning. He says, when Adam and Eve were told about this thing called marriage, divorce was never mentioned. It wasn't an option. It wasn't alluded to. And that continued to be the case, as far as we know, until Deuteronomy chapter 24. We need to remember that. This is the baseline. This is God's starting point on this subject. I hate divorce. I never wanted it. I didn't permit it to Adam and Eve. I didn't permit it to people for 2,000 years. And only after 40 years of willfulness on the part of the Jews, because I had a bigger thing to accomplish for the time being, did I permit it under the circumstances I did in Deuteronomy 24. But I want you to know, I don't want it. And it's not my best. It's not what I want for you. It was never the best. All that said, God continues to give one reason where he allows divorce and remarriage. Verse 9, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Jesus allows divorce and remarriage to a different person on one condition. And it's the only condition anywhere in the New Testament it's ever offered. And that is for sexual immorality. What is sexual immorality? Our King James uses the word fornication. The Greek word is porneia, P-O-R-N-E-I-A. You can recognize that in pornography. Porneia means unlawful sexual intercourse. God has only legitimized sexual intercourse within marriage. So any time that takes place outside of marriage, it is sexual immorality. That includes heterosexual, homosexual, and bestial. The Bible mentions all of those, so I mention all of them. These things fall into sexual immorality, and if that takes place on the part of one of the spouses, the innocent spouse, Jesus says, may divorce them for that reason. But if they divorce them for any reason other than that, if they do not divorce for that reason and they go and remarry another, what does Jesus say? They commit adultery. Now, what is adultery? Adultery comes from the Greek word moichao. To commit adultery is moichao, M-O-I-X-A-O. And if we look at adultery from the beginning to the end of the Bible, adultery is a sexual sin. And it is a sexual sin that involves violating a marriage covenant. All adultery is sexual immorality, but not all sexual immorality is adultery. Because sexual immorality involves any kind of sexual intercourse outside of marriage, but adultery involves sexual intercourse outside of marriage when one of them involved in it is married. And this is an important point we don't ever want to miss. If I divorce my wife, and I'm only saying I to help it be understandable here. If I divorce my wife for some reason other than sexual immorality and I go and I marry another, which presumes I will be engaging in the sexual relationship with them, Jesus says I will be committing adultery. Against whom? Mark chapter 10 verse 11, I'll be committing adultery against the woman I just divorced. Well, how can you commit adultery against someone you've divorced? She's not my wife. Apparently she is. I have divorced her, but I did not divorce her for the one reason the Lord Jesus gave. And so the marriage covenant has not been broken. Let the law say what it will. Let me say what I will. The marriage covenant has not been broken. And when I sleep with that woman I just married, according to the law, I will be committing adultery against my wife, to whom I am still married. Again, let the law say what it will. Sexual immorality is the only legitimate biblical grounds for divorce. God hates it. Again, Paul states in 1 Corinthians 7 verse 11 that a husband is not to divorce his wife and vice versa. God permits divorce only on the grounds that he permits it to himself. In Hosea chapter 2, verse 2, God said to the nation of Israel, actually to Hosea about the nation of Israel, bring charges against your mother, that's the nation, bring charges, for she is not my wife, nor am I her husband. Let her put away her harlotries from her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts. Notice, when he speaks of adultery, it's clearly speaking of the sexual act. She has gone and followed all these other gods. She's gone and put her trust in all these other nations. And when she's done that, she's been committing spiritual adultery against me. And I have come to the point now, I have divorced her. And since God permits divorce to himself on those grounds, he permits it to us. That doesn't mean that just because it occurs, there has to be a divorce. Jesus never says that, but it's permitted. Let's move to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. This subject is so big, but we have to work within the time here. And I'm not complaining. It's an admission here that I know there's some important points that we're not addressing. Please feel free to come and discuss those with me at any point after our session. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, we're going to begin in verse 10. And we'll just read all the way to verse 15. Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife. But to the rest I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe, and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. All right, let's first of all notice this phrase in verse 10. Paul says, now to the married, I what? All right, I command. And yet he says, it's not I, but... All right. I struggled with this part of 1 Corinthians 7 for years. I could not figure out what was going on. The way I read it at first, Paul's making this command in verse 10, and he's saying, okay, I'm commanding this, but the command doesn't originate with me. It, of course, originates with the Lord. So what follows here is a command of the Lord's. But then in verse 12, he goes, but to the rest, I, not the Lord. And so that's, well, it sounded like Paul's saying, look, this is just coming from me, and this isn't an inspired command from the Lord. And then you read it, and he's, so Paul writes this big old paragraph, and it's only his thinking, and he's making all these commands, but it's not commands. What's going on? I had a four-hour conversation with a brother in Ozark, Missouri, at a Shoney's, and in that conversation, he opened my eyes to what I think this is, what Paul is actually saying. Paul, in verses 10 and 11, is issuing the very same command that Jesus did when he walked the earth. Jesus told us what two people who claim to be God's people are supposed to do with respect to marriage, divorce, and remarriage. He was speaking to the Jewish people. They were the covenant people. Paul is now speaking to Christians, covenant people. And when you have two Christians who are married, here's what God expects of them. And so Paul's not saying, I'm not really commanding this. He's simply saying, this is not new with me. I'm recapitulating here what Jesus himself said while he walked on the earth. But when we get to verse 12... he says, I, not the Lord. Not that this isn't from the Lord, but not this is not something the Lord addressed while he was walking the earth. Because Jesus never gave us the commands for what you do when you have a person who's a covenant, who's a member of his kingdom, and someone who's not. So Paul's going to address that question. Verses 10 and 11, though. A wife is not to depart from her husband. Depart, chorizo, C-H-O-R-I-Z-O in the Greek. What does this mean? I used to think this meant, well, she's not to leave him. And that's certainly kind of the way it reads at first. That's not what Paul's saying. This word depart is the very same word Jesus used in Matthew 19:6 when he said, let what God has joined together, let not man separate or put asunder. When Jesus said put asunder or separate, he was talking about breaking up the marriage. When Paul says here a wife is not to depart from her husband, he is saying she's not to divorce her husband. Well, how do you know that? Well, look at the very verse itself, verse 11. But if she does depart, let her remain what? Unmarried. To depart is to divorce. Well, then why didn't Paul use the word divorce? Because depart had come has been brought together with divorce all the way back in Deuteronomy 24:1-2. When a man put a certificate of divorce in his wife's hand, what would she do? Take a guess. She would depart. That's what Deuteronomy 24:2 says. He would put that certificate of divorce in her hand, send her out, she would depart. So to depart was to divorce. So Paul uses these terms interchangeably, just like I might say stop and whoa. They mean the same thing. So in verse 10, a wife is not to depart from her husband. She's not to divorce him. But if she does depart, that's okay. I just said you're not supposed to do it, but God knows we don't always obey what he says. So here you've got two Christians, and a Christian has just divorced his Christian spouse. He was not supposed to. She wasn't supposed to, but they've done it. Now what? Well, was the divorce for sexual immorality? Apparently not. Because if the divorce were for sexual immorality, the innocent party would be free to remarry. Jesus was very clear about that. But here, since the divorce was not for sexual immorality, verse 11, what's she to do? But if she does divorce, she shouldn't have done it, but if she does it, let her remain unmarried. That is, according to the law. Or else be reconciled to her. Because he really still is her husband. The divorce was not for sexual immorality. The marriage covenant has not been broken, even though the civil law says so. And the divorce was not for sexual immorality, as I just said. So, they're to remain unmarried, or they can be reconciled once again. But now in verse 12, Paul addresses something that Jesus had not addressed while on the earth. to the rest I, not the Lord, say, if any brother who has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. The early church would have been made up of many people who were married before they were converted. So here, as we see today, sometimes one will accept the gospel and the other doesn't. So now here's this Christian brother in the church, and he's got a wife who's not a Christian. But she's willing to stay in the marriage. She's willing to live with him, be a part of the marriage. And so what does Paul say? If she's willing to stay in the marriage, what should you not do, Christian brother? Don't divorce her. And then in verse 13, he flips it and says the same thing of women. Roman women could divorce their husbands. Greek women could divorce their husbands. Even though Jewish women may not have been able to do this, Gentile women could. So sister, if you've got an unbelieving husband, if he's willing to stay in the marriage, then don't divorce him. Why did Paul have to tell these Christian spouses not to divorce their unbelieving spouses? I mean, why would a question like that even come up? Why would a Christian spouse be thinking, well, I'm going to divorce this unbeliever I'm married to? I'm so deaf, I can hear the sound, but I can't hear the words. I feel like the people with Paul. All through the Bible, what's been God's standard? While they wandered in the wilderness, God said, in that transition time, if you capture some Gentiles, you can marry one of them. Although that woman, the Gentile woman you marry is going to need to go through this elaborate procedure before you marry her. But once you get into the promised land, Deuteronomy chapter 7, you are not to marry anyone who is not a fellow Jew. Now, they don't have to be a Jew by ethnicity. They don't have to be a Jew by race. But they do need to be a Jew by religion. Ruth said, your God will be my God, your people will be my people. She became a Jew, and so righteous Boaz could marry her. And in Malachi chapter 2, God said that any man who married a woman who did not serve the Lord, in other words, who was not a Jew by faith, may the Lord cut off from the tents of Jacob the man who does this thing, being awake and aware. Can there be stronger language? We come into the new covenant. I just want to comment on that. Christians are to marry Christians. That's the repeated theme throughout Scripture. If a Christian widow, if her husband dies, she may remarry, but it's to be a Christian. These people were contemplating divorce. Why? Because they knew Christians aren't supposed to be married to non-Christians. And so they thought, well, maybe I should divorce my spouse. And Paul says, whoa. No, don't do that. You do have a covenant here that you got started before you became a Christian. And God wants you to keep your promises. If they're willing to stay with you, stay in that marriage. However, verse 15, if the unbeliever is bent on leaving, and they divorce you, they depart, they divorce, what are you as a Christian supposed to do? You know God doesn't want you to break this up. You know God wants you to be faithful. But if they are bent on leaving, and they file on you, what are you supposed to do? You let him. Let him depart. A brother or sister, verse 15, is not under bondage in such cases. And this has raised a lot of questions down through the years. What's that mean? Not under bondage. In chapter 7 here, in this very same chapter, in verse 27 and in verse 39, as well as in Romans chapter 7, verse 2, Paul speaks of being bound to your spouse. So if you're married, that means you're bound. So if you're not under bondage, it's been reasoned, that must mean that you're no longer in the marriage. In other words, if the unbeliever departs, they divorce you, you're no longer in that marriage, you're no longer bound to that person in a covenant, and you're now free to remarry. That's been the argument. And it's easy to see how someone would come to that conclusion. But there are multiple problems with that. For one, Paul doesn't say anything about remarriage. He speaks of remarriage explicitly three times in the New Testament. Once in 1 Corinthians 7, once in Romans 7, once in 1 Timothy 5. And every single time Paul speaks explicitly of remarriage, he always mentions the death of the spouse. Every single time. But secondly, When Paul speaks of being bound to a spouse in those other passages, he uses the Greek word deo, D-E-O, which means to be constrained by law or duty. When he speaks of not being under bondage here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 15, he uses a completely different word, totally different word. He's not saying you're no longer bound. He's saying you're no longer under bondage. This word means to be like a slave, to make one subservient to another's interests. You are no longer bound to try to keep that person in your home, to try to fulfill the obligations of being married to that individual. If they want to leave, you let them leave. God has called us to peace. Don't make a fight about it. You're not obligated to try to keep this marriage together. If they are bent on leaving because they're an unbeliever, let them leave. You're no longer enslaved to their interest. What might an unbeliever do? He decides, I don't want to be in this marriage anymore. I didn't sign up to be married to a Christian. Takes off, and then, 3-6 months later, things haven't worked out so well. And he's thinking, I still don't want to go back and live with her, but I know she still thinks I'm her husband. I'm going to go back and I'm going to make some demands. Is this unbelievable? We know how people are. She's not obligated to meet those demands. He left. She's no longer under bondage. One man put it this way. Paul is not saying that the believer is no longer bound by his marriage covenant that he made with the unbeliever. He only means that the believer is not under compulsion, as a slave would be, to remain at all costs and fulfill his marital responsibilities. The Christian does not have to force himself upon the unbeliever who's bent on leaving. He does not have to fight the unbeliever's decision in order to maintain the union. If such a course of action were required, it would indeed reduce the believer to a form of slavery, and it wouldn't be peaceful. Notice he follows that up. As soon as he says, you're no longer under bondage, he says, God has called us to peace. If they want to leave, let them leave. You're not obligated to try to keep this together, as you would be if it were a Christian. So when we look at the scriptures, there are four groups of people who we know have a right to marry. Those who've never been married, those who've been widowed, the innocent party who divorced his spouse for sexual immorality, and those who are being reconciled. These are the four groups who we know have a right to marry. Of course, the question arises, what if, John, I find myself in a second marriage, but I'm not in one of those four groups? I was in a divorce. I divorced for reasons other than sexual immorality, and I went and I married another. I don't know if there's anyone in the room right now who finds himself or herself in this situation, so please know I'm not singling you out if that's the case. But I know these situations exist. If you were a Christian and you divorced your spouse for reasons other than sexual immorality, and you went and remarried, I will tell you what I believe I would need to do if I were in your situation. I'm not going to bind it as gospel. I'm convinced enough that it's right that I would do it. But I know the Lord's going to be the judge on these things ultimately. I'll share my thoughts quickly. A river does not rise above its source. Rivers don't get higher. They lower. Sin is never grandfathered into righteousness. And doing wrong does not create privileges for me that I would not have had if I had done right. When the Jews entered into marriages that were a violation of the law of Moses in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, what was the decision they made? Ezra chapter 10, verse 3, it was decided. They had married women who followed after idols. The law had very specifically prohibited this. They had even had children. You think, well, the clear thing is you keep this marriage together. No. They said, we're going to break up these marriages, Ezra 10, 3, according to the law. When John the Baptist approached Herod Antipas was a brother to Philip, who was another one of the tetrarchs in the region of Israel and Palestine. Philip had been married to Herodias, but Herodias wanted to be married to Herod. What did the law say about marrying your brother's wife while your brother was still living? The law was very clear. You don't do it. You don't uncover your brother's nakedness. Well, so Philip and Herodias get a divorce, and Herodias goes and she marries Herod. They've gone through the civil process of a divorce and the civil process of a remarriage. They've made a covenant. Surely this second marriage is okay. What did John the Baptist say to Herod? It is not lawful for you to be married to your brother's wife. Mark chapter 6, verses 17 and 18. Matthew chapter 14, verse 4. What was John saying? You've gone through the process, you've gone through the ceremonies, but it's not lawful. It wasn't okay for you to get the marriage wasn't okay on the day of, and Herod, it's still not okay. Doing something wrong doesn't make it okay. You're not to divorce your wife for reasons other than sexual immorality and marry another. It's not, well, since you did it, now you can. That's what I would be bound by in my conscience. I don't believe those men in the days of Ezra stopped caring for those women. I don't think they stopped caring for the children. But the marriage wasn't right to begin with, and it wasn't right even after it had been going on for a long time. Somebody once said, and maybe some of you have heard it said publicly, that this issue of marriage, divorce, and remarriage is the first and second hardest subject we deal with in the church. And I will say a hearty amen to that. One man said this: I feel unable to deal with some of the cases, even in a way that is satisfactory to myself. And in any case, I feel humbled and weak by the gravity of the situation. I agree with that 100%. Multiple times I am presented with things and I'm not exactly sure how to answer. I know for myself, I dare not let uncertainty result in ungodly leniency. God's made laws, brethren, and we need to be careful to observe them. God hates divorce, and He's only given us one grounds for to end, if the spouse is still living, to end a marriage and engage in a remarriage. Everything else is gray at best.